Every year in my town, there's this fantastic crafts in the park. It's always the day before Mother's Day, so it's fun to go and shop and get lots of cool stuff. At any rate, I came across One Earth Body Care, and it changed my life. Now, you may think I'm being hyperbolic, but I'm not. I am extraordinarily smelly, and I have tried every natural deodorant under the sun. Nothing has worked except for their fantastic natural deodorant. They have a variety of scents. They are non-greasy, cream-based formula, baking soda free. Magnesium hydroxide keeps odor at bay. And let me tell you, it sure does. Organic and gentle. And they have wonderful, enchanting essential oil aromas. My favorite is vanilla rose. There's vanilla spice, lavender lime, lemongrass, cedar, sage. They also have wonderful shampoo bars, changed my daughter's life. Her hair looks amazing, and conditioner bars. They have wonderful salves for dry skin and so much more. So please check them out at oneearthbodycare.com. I'm Lisa Davis. So glad you're listening to Health Power. It is Friday, which means it is time for Dr. John Trentalage. Dr. John is a wonderful therapist. He has been one for over 30 years. He's got a doctorate in psychology, and he is the author of Making Movies in Our Minds, Working Through Anxiety. And he is my personal psychologist, and it has helped me immensely in the short time we've been working together. Like, amazing. So Dr. John, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Lisa. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
You know, John, I'm thinking, maybe we need a title for this, like Dr. John's Corner or Dr. John's Brilliant Psychological Advice. I'll let you think on that. I'm obviously not good at creating titles.
Okay. Well, I was going to say the same. I'm good at I've created a lot of techniques over the years, but I'm not really good with titles. Yes.
I like Dr. John's Corner. You know, it's like a little space. All right. So everybody, welcome to Dr. John's Corner.
Okay.
All right, Dr. John. Today we're going to be talking about attachment. What makes secure versus insecure attachment? Last week, we talked about the foundational year. So if you missed that, you might want to go listen to that one first, because these are going to kind of stack up on each other, some of them. But if not, you can stay and go back. Either way, just make sure you don't miss a word of this brilliant man. All right. So let's talk about attachment. Tell us about how old this topic of attachment is.
This goes back to 1938 by a British psychiatrist by the name of John Bowlby, created this area of attachment.
What is attachment? And it has to do with how you are with your children, right? And how attached you are to your parents?
Well, see, I'm glad that you said that, because I'm also going to give the listeners some tips on some psychologists and therapists who would say, I'm going to be bold there, Lisa, and say they claim that they know attachment when I say they really don't. So what is the difference is that when an individual talks about attachment to someone, they're not understanding attachment. Attachment is internal. It's internal. Yes, it has to do with relationships, but much more than that. So a lot in that first question is, Bowlby said that the relationship that we form in our early childhoods with our primary caregiver creates an internal blueprint, a mental stigma for all relationships that we form throughout life. But he also talked about an internal working model. So the individuals who truly know attachment understand that the internal working model is what I call an executive functioner. It's where everything comes out of. Us attachment experts will say all pathology, or the majority of pathology, comes from that secure base, that internal working model that says, I will be okay. I will be okay in a relationship. I will be okay outside a relationship. I will be okay in a new experience. Okay. And out. So there's obviously a theme there. I'm not just repeating myself for the sake of repeating myself. I'm saying this is the base. I'm okay.
Okay. But if you have an insecure attachment, you're not going to have that base of being okay.
When you have an insecure, and there's different types of insecure attachment.
You talk to us about those.
It is that a person, and these are Bowlby's terms that other therapists, psychologists have changed the names, but basically is if you hear the term preoccupied, Bowlby referred to that as anxious ambivalent, meaning there's a lot of anxiety in the relationship. There's a lot of anxiety in approaching something new. Attachment is best measured through transitions. You know, changing classes, even in preschool, going from circle time to outside free time, transitions. And so when you have anxious ambivalent, it's like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to be okay. Another form or pattern or style of attachment, of insecure attachment, is avoidant. I just want to be by myself in order to protect myself.
Right.
Another form that's very popular, unfortunately, these days, is disorganized attachment. Those are the children who have the biggest behavior problems in school. Then there's on the extreme, you have what is called reactive attachment disorder. Children that, if they don't get treated, will form sociopath as an adult. Yes. So all of this stuff, including being a sociopath, is you're raised that way. You're not born that way.
That's what I was about to ask. So the nature versus nurture, because I've often thought, what makes a sociopath? They have to have, I would assume, a lot of abuse or some kind of neglect to have them have insecure attachments.
Very good, Lisa. The number one thing that most psychologists will agree upon is the etiology or cause for a sociopath is severe pathological neglect.
Oh, okay.
For those folks who have heard the name Charles Manson,
yes.
His mother was a prostitute. He lived a lot of his life going from motel room to motel room and doesn't know who his father, didn't know who his father was, and just a lot of neglect. I think he left school at like 8 years old, 9 years old. Ted Bundy, all of these individuals had that. Also, personally, I used to specialize in working with children who had this, and every child I worked with had intentionally killed the family pet.
Oh my gosh. That is so scary. Now, is there help if you get to a child like this soon enough?
Yes. Matter of fact, okay. I worked with, I don't know why they were mostly girls, but my clientele with children that were, you know, reactive attachment disorder, because you can't diagnose somebody with a sociopath under the age of 18, but with children with reactive attachment disorder, yes, there is things such as, you know, gentle connections, listening to mom, dad's heartbeat every morning, every night, being able to enhance that attachment, being able to rewire the trust, lots of structure, but not in a military way or a cruel way, but in a loving way. Here are the rules. Here's the consequences for breaking those rules. There's also a technique called, everyone has heard of time out. There's a technique called time in, which involves the parent. That means that the child has to sit next to the parent. I call it knee to knee, but there's no talking, no TV, no radio, no stimulation. You're just sitting there. And for a 4 or 5 year old, you're sitting there, and I usually recommend 2 minutes of sitting there. 2 minutes for a 4 year old is like 30 minutes to an adult.
Yeah.
And the rule is that the child has to sit still for that period of time, no talking. Then when they're done with that, then they're going to listen to mom or dad's heart. But basically, when that child knows that he or she does not want to be in control, that they don't need to be in control, that there's a safety net, that really rewires the brain to be the person that they were always created to be.
Okay. Yeah, I love that. That makes a lot of sense. Now, when my daughter was a baby, I practiced something called attachment parenting. You wear the child all the time. the child sleeps in your bed or in a little thing connected to your bed. Part of the reason was because my daughter, which we will learn later, was on the autism spectrum and she never slept and she was sensitive to everything and it was very difficult, but having her right on me was very helpful. And yes. She was on top of me, which people would say, oh, you can't, why are you? And I was like, well, first of all, they don't understand there's something going on, but that's the only way she would sleep. And by the time she was one, we got her off me. This was rough. But what do you think if you don't have a child with special needs who needs that extra, you know, like she really had no self-regulation. She wasn't going to do the verbalization, which I don't agree with anyway, but she really needed that in order to even get a few hours of sleep a night. I mean, it was hard. So what do you say for like a neurotypical or a child who doesn't have, you know, neurological issues? How much attachment do you think is good?
This goes into, Lisa, what I want to listen about, understand that attachment is internalized. Some individuals who don't know attachment may say something like, well, a child's overattached, you're always clinging to me. No, attachment is a paradox. The more secure the child is, the less the child needs the parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay. In third world countries, there is very low insecure attachment. One of the reasons is there are countries, and you might have liked this, Lisa, when you were pregnant, is there is third world countries where the mom for 9 months does nothing but lay in the hammock and the village waits on her all the time.
That would have been nice. I have a very supportive husband. I'm very lucky. Kind of sense.
Yes, that's great. I'm glad that you did and do. And so here's another thing is the United States has the worst, you know, program for maternal leave in the world. We have the worst.
Terrible.
There are countries like Denmark that give both parents 2 years off with pay and a guarantee that they have a job when they come back.
That's amazing. That is amazing. And I know in other countries too, they often all their kids sleep in the room when they're little and it makes a difference.
It's always one of the things that I thank you for bringing it up. I always say to parents, it's best to bring the crib into the room and have the, and sleep in the same room. There's something that some listeners may get upset with me about, but it's my attachment is my passion. And it's this, there's a rule of thumb that's going around to young parents that say, let the baby just cry. He or she will stop if you do that. Yes, the baby will stop crying, but the baby is at high risk of insecure attachment because crying is a language and they're saying, I'm scared. And the parent and adults don't stop and think. Separation from mom, especially mom, but both parents is huge. And think about this. We just recently had an eclipse, okay?
Yeah.
This separation of night and day is huge.
Right.
And so having that baby sleep in the same room for the first year and a half is key.
Yeah, we had a nursery, like we had a room and we painted it and we put cute little stuffed animals or whatever, but she still slept in our room. And I think even if she didn't have the struggles that she had, she still would have slept in her room. I think something that's so sad too is, you know, when my mom was like in the 50s and 60s, they were saying bottle is better than breast, which is nonsense. And so that, you know, I nursed Lila and people will shake their heads, but Lila stopped when she was 3. Now, by then, she wasn't nursing that much, but it was just now and then for comfort. And, you know, but I remember when she was 3, it was so funny. She literally turned 3 and she's like, you know, mom, I've had, it's enough already. And I'm like, thank God. She's a very verbal, unusual, bright child, but overstimulated a lot. So that would help. But that was one of the things that calmed her down. But at any rate, that was a big shame too, that doctors were telling women that. It's crazy.
Most definitely. And there was a psychologist goes, they went before my time, goes back to the 50s by the name of Dr. Spock. He used to say,
oh, my mom had his book. Okay, yeah.
Don't pick up a child. What most people know of that, but most people don't know, Lisa, is what Dr. Spock basically said in his dying words, which was this: I think I ruined an entire generation.
Having a great therapist is so important for so many of us. And I have found the best therapist that I've ever worked with, and I've worked with quite a few. I am talking about Dr. John Trentalage. He goes by Dr. John, and he has a segment here on Health Power every Friday. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. John. He's a clinician. He specializes in assisting individuals heal from emotional trauma, anxiety, depression, relationship issues, attachment issues, and more. Dr. John is the author of Making Movies in Our Minds, Working Through Our Anxiety. He draws on his close to 30 years of experience to offer techniques that he and his clients have used to diminish anxiety, work through depression, and build stronger connections with self and others. In addition to working as a clinician, Dr. John has created parenting curriculum, early childhood educator curriculum, and has literally trained over 35,000 parents, directors, teachers, school counselors, psychologists, and social workers. Dr. John also created curriculum and provided training for adoptive parents. Dr. John created in-home intensive training for foster and adoptive parents. Dr. John also has created a very unique treatment model for healing your inner child. Dr. John is available for psychological assistance in either therapy, consultation, conferences, trainings, presentations, or speaking engagements. Dr. John is available through text at 719-310-9495 or email Trentalage at netzero.com. That's Trentalage at netzero.com. Dr. John has helped me immensely in a very short amount of time. And I am blessed that he came into my life. And I'm thrilled that he'll be here every Friday to help you. And I encourage you, if you're looking for somebody who really knows how to help, contact Dr. John. Didn't the Ferberizing guy, I also read that he said he's against his own method now to let the baby cry it out.
Yes. And so basically I say this. And so I've had parents argue with me over the years, well, you're spoiling the child by picking up the child. No, because this is how I say address this. Pick up the child when the child needs to be picked up, wants to be picked up. When the child doesn't want to be picked up, pick up the child, pick up the child, pick up the child. What that does is to the child's brain is, I'm confused. Mom, dad pick me up all the time. So so it's not about being spoiled if you do it that way.
Exactly.
Also, third world countries, the woman is working in the field. They actually give birth right then and there while they're working. And then they pick up the child and they have the child close to their chest at all times.
I think that's so beautiful. Gosh, the water, you know, my parents joke, you know, I joke around that I was raised by a swing and a pacifier because I loved my pacifier. You couldn't take it away from me at all. And my parents would tell me, oh, you were a baby. You love this swing. We'd leave you in there for hours. You and your past, you're so happy. And I'm thinking, yeah, I don't think I was that happy. I got a lot of insecure attachment. I mean, it was a different time. I'm not saying they were terrible parents because of that, but it was definitely, they took more of that hands-off approach. I mean, at the same time, there was lots of hugs and kisses on the cheek and there was affection. That was nice. But there was still more of that 1970s, 1960s kind of parenting that I'm not a big fan of.
I think a lot of parents get confused. One of my pet peeves is that when I see parents walking with their two, as a child or youngest two, in the parking lot when letting the child just walk or run. When I taught a couple of people how to drive, and I would say most people are scared of the freeway. The most dangerous place to drive is the parking lot. And so it's like, why? I'm teaching my kids independence. No, you're not. You're teaching them to not go to you. So I say to parents who don't hold their child's hand when the child is young, don't you dare question why the child's not coming to you when the child's a teenager. You taught the child not to come to you.
That's so interesting. That is that. Wow. See, there's Dr. John, this corner of yours, Dr. John's corner here on Health Power every Friday, is so helpful because there's, I know every adult I know is struggling. Either they have a mental illness that was caused by trauma, or they have some other issue, or their relationships are a mess, or their self-esteem is in the garbage, and it's all traced back to their families.
Because, right? And that's a whole nother topic, Lisa, but let's tap into that a little bit, that everything pretty much comes from childhood. It's not, and it's not genetics. And right. if the listener really wants to know the secret, is psychologist, here's the secret. And that's why I'm being, you know, a little bit dramatic when I say, here's the secret, is psychologists can't get funding if they say it's the parents' fault. So they put it on genetics. It's not genetics, folks. Hear my passion. It's not genetics. Everything comes from childhood.
Right. Wow. That's intense.
Thank you.
But it's true. You know, it's interesting, though. I think, though, so you talked about this in the anxiety interview, so I don't want to rehash it too much. But I was saying that I do know people who had a pretty good childhood, and yet they get diagnosed with, like, generalized anxiety disorder. Are you saying that, and yet you look throughout their family and they have anxiety, but you also obviously have to look at the way, why? Like, what was the intergenerational trauma or things like that? But you don't think anyone could just have something? It has to be caused or by...
That's a great, great question. So anxiety is complex because, see, one of the things, and here's another significant point, if any listeners are parents, I'm not saying that you have to step on every toe or that you have to walk on eggshells with your child.
Right.
But you have to understand that consistency is king and key in that we're going to screw up. Okay. But what I mean by consistency is we have to be careful of the messages that we give, not just with our words, but our behaviors.
Okay.
Another technique I would do back in the day was I would do in-home therapy. There would be dads who would attempt, as I'm talking to their child, would attempt to step outside to go for a smoke. And it's like, where are you going? That gives the child, well, I'm listening, I'm doing that. That gives the child the message that it's not important what I'm saying. I mean, right. So little things like that give messages to individuals, especially and here's something for also for the parents is children are sponges to their environment. So whatever happens to them, near them, around them is about them.
Yes, you're so right, Dr. John. You know, I'm curious. I would wonder about, because of attachment, I'm curious about when you parentify a child. And that happened to my sister and I because my mom was chronically ill and we had to take care of her. And that would that affect attachment, or does that just cause other, definitely causes other issues? I'll tell you that. You can't be a kid.
Oh, so I grew up with a lot of abuse and a lot of neglect. My mother had a mental illness, what is referred to as DID today. She had
that. Oh, really?
growing
I
up.
I let people know that used to be called multiple personality disorder.
Yes, folks, it used to be called multiple personality disorder. And now it's called dissociative identity disorder, but multiple personality disorder. And I would see my mom change that. So the positive side of that was I learned how to read people real well.
Wow.
But the negative side of that is, it caused attachment problems. I also raised my mom, I said, and it's like that creates a lot of problems. So, yes, that's here's an analogy I've used with parents. If you're on a plane and you're hitting turbulence, you want the pilot to say what the pilot says. Folks, sit down, please, buckle up. I got this. You don't want the pilot to say over the loudspeaker, folks, we're hitting turbulence. Do whatever feels good to you. you want somebody and need somebody to be in control. That young child, and a lot of parents will say, well, the child's arguing with me about the rules. You're not paying attention. The child is arguing about the rules because the child wants to hear the word no. Needs to hear the word no. That creates safety for the child.
Wow. Dr. John, this is absolutely incredible. So let's talk about steps. And I think you covered this in what you've been talking about, but anything else about how a parent, what they can do to enhance their child's attachment?
Yeah, don't personalize things. It's not about being a bad parent.
Okay.
You know, sometimes, you know, a whole other subject is ADD, ADHD. I worked with a lot of ADD and a lot of ADHD kids. I have 100% batting average with this. And 100% batting average is every mom who has a child with ADD, ADHD that I have talked to so far, that was an anxious, stressful pregnancy.
Oh,
doesn't make you bad. So listen to the folks real loud and clear. It doesn't make you bad. I call it the HB syndrome, Lisa. The HB syndrome, human being. Okay, we all struggle with the HB syndrome, human being. So it just means, what can you do? Again, gentle connections, because attachment begins in the womb, listening to the heart. Another thing you could do is, you could actually Google this, obviously. There's a piece of music that Beethoven composed, the heartbeat structure. The rules are the same. The consequences are the same. It's not about punishment. It's about safety. It's about discipline. It's about being able to say, honey, you did. And a lot of people say, oh, what if you're mad? Well, I created a whole program called Discipline Without Emotion. It's basically, you did this wrong. Here's the consequence. We'll talk about this. We'll talk about what you could do differently next time you're angry. So being able to allow, so the parent allowing the child to have their emotions.
Yes, it's huge.
At the same time, and a lot of it, I work with a lot of adults who don't understand this. There's a difference between emotions, which are inside, and behavior that's outside.
Yes.
And children get this faster than adults. It's like, what do I mean? Well, I'm throwing things because I'm angry. That's a behavior. And so being able to teach children that consistency, predictability, bed is always the same time every night, waking up the same time. So basically, the rules don't change. Also, another key thing, and maybe we need to do a segment on this alone, Lisa, is what I refer to as the United Front. Every child comes into this world with the same mission, any child anywhere in the world. And what's that mission that the child comes into the world with? Divide and conquer. You know, mom, dad lets me have a cookie before dinner.
Yes.
Dad, mom, you know, daddy, you're so lovable. I mean, there is children do use manipulate. I love you so much, daddy. You know, mom and dad have to parent together as united front. And that starts with, you know, as weird as it may sound to some of the listeners, is what are the family values that you want that child to have? Children, adults are produced, they're raised.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, I remember those kinds of things. You know, my mom was a health food nut, and my dad would, sometimes she knew, but sometimes he'd like, we want ice cream. And that's that, you know, like, I want ice cream. We're going to go. And, you know, but it was just more like, or, but dad said I could have this thing or whatever. But eventually my dad got on board, and like, we would go, but he would take a stroke because my mom wasn't feeling well most of the time. So he'd go grocery shopping, and I go, Dad, can I have this? Not on the list. Is your mother? She didn't put it on the list. So eventually he realized he needed to get with the program.
And another thing that parents can really do, I just was working with a couple today that did, gently, but I confronted the dad, even though it was gentle, confronted the dad. It's like, you don't have to be so serious. You know, did the child follow the rules or not? He was very surprised. And I said, your homework is to go celebrate that your kids are following the rules.
Right.
People, whether they're a child or an adult, needs to be rewarded. When we are rewarded, we want to do more of that same thing.
Yep. That is true. Well, Dr. John, you're fantastic. Is there anything else you wanted to add about attachment today? And everyone, every Friday, Dr. John's Corner is a great way to start your weekend, really to understand how to be a better parent, how to help yourself if you didn't have a good parent, understanding psychology of yourself. I mean, there's so much, Dr. John. I'm so excited. But was there anything you wanted to wrap up today on attachment?
Yeah, just like I said, I'd be very passionate about this, Lisa, is that attachment is much more than just internal. Attachment is, you know, being successful people, I'm convinced, have a more secure attachment. It's not about intelligence, it's about being able to believe in yourself, taking risk, being okay when you fail. So if you don't have that, there's hope and help for you to get that, to repair it. I do a lot of teach a lot of adults how to reparent themselves. If you have children, there's also hope there that you can build that healthy attachment now. Start with where you're at.
Exactly. I love that. All right. So remember, everyone, go and get Dr. John's book, Making Movies in Our Minds, Working Through Anxiety. You can get it at Barnes & Noble online or Amazon. And I'm also going to put in the show notes your email, which is trentalage@netzero.com. If you do have a pencil of your old school, that's trentalage@netzero.com. Dr. John, anything you wanted to add?
No, just I said, email me. And if you're looking for services, come and go ahead and call me. You know, I charge $90 for a full hour.
That's amazing.
You know, and so, yeah, there's a lot of therapists these days are charging outrageous wages. Outrageous wages. And so it's like, no, 90 bucks for a full hour. And so not just 15-minute stuff either, full hour. And I am there with you folks. I will walk you through the process of creating healthy, you know, loving homes.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm working with Dr. John, and he's absolutely fabulous. I can't recommend him highly enough. Everybody keeps coming back 5 days a week. And again, rate, review, subscribe. And every Friday, it's Dr. John's Corner. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for our show today. Thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you, and we would appreciate it if you could please rate and review and leave a comment, because the more you engage with our podcast, the more you will find it and help other people find it wherever they listen to their podcast. So be sure to follow us. I'm at Andrea Donsky and at Naturally Savvy, and Lisa
at Lisa Davis MPH.
Thank you so much. And please share this episode, because the more you share shows you care. We'll see you next time.